There is no health without mental health. Join Brian Green for Mental Wealth on 103.2 Dublin City FM each Tuesday at 12:30 p.m. Your mental health awareness station on 103.2 Dublin City FM with Brian Green.
Good afternoon and welcome to Mental Wealth with me, Brian Green. That's our new intro. What do you think? Thanks to Declan for the voiceover on that. Also new to the programme this week is I've got helpers for the first time in 2 years. We have some assistants to make the show, so you will be hearing from Pia and Joe over the next coming weeks and months, taking part in Mental Wealth. And first and foremost, today they will be heading off to Dáil Éireann to interview Senator Máire Devine. And secondly on the programme today, I'll be heading to Imro in Dublin, where the RTE Choice Prize Conversations kind of fringe thing was on there last week, and we were talking music and mental health with the chairperson of Imro, Eleanor McAvoy, and Aoife Ruth from BIM. That's coming up a little later in the programme. So first to Máire Devine. She has tabled some legislation in the Senate, and hopefully will be bringing in this legislation that, let me see, how will I explain it? Let's get Máire to explain it herself, then we'll go to the Dáil for the interview.
I'm here explaining the Health Act of 1970. Within that act, patients who are mentally seriously unwell and involuntarily detained against their will are charged for the involuntary detention. €80 per day up to €800 per 12 months. This is grossly unfair. It goes against equality and human rights. And I have the legislation I'll be lodging within the Senate tomorrow to seek that this no longer happens. Guru Mahago.
Good morning, Máire. Thanks very much for meeting with us today. So the first question for you today is, at first, could you please explain the issue that people are charged for involuntary detention, and what do you want to change about it?
Okay, much and what? See Mr. Shankton McGeagher on Google and Focal. I suppose this came across myself and when a couple of people who had been involuntarily detained within the mental health services, approved centres, they call the hospitals, asked me, do they need to pay the €800 that was billed to them? And I thought, wow, that's such an injustice. That's a health injustice. I thought, if you are involuntarily detained, and the involuntary detention by its nature is you don't want to be there, you don't feel that you need to be there, you feel, and you're going to have your freedom, your liberty restricted completely and utterly because you're going to end up under the care and direction and instruction of those within the approved centres. So €800 you're given the bill when you leave. There's no way on earth that I would want to pay for something, or any of my family or friends, for something that I did not want. So I did some research into it. Overall, per year, there's about 2,000 to 2,500 people who are involuntarily detained. The HSE financially haven't a clue who's paying, why they're paying, so they don't have it broken down into different modules. All right, but we found that out when we were on the Mental Health Committee. Anyhow, the financial prudence, the financial accountability is extremely lacking in the HSE, and I need to say that again and again. So it's not surprising that this was overlooked. I don't think it's the intention of people to actually bill extremely vulnerable and fragile individuals for their stay in an approved centre, but because it's not in law, it's not written down, people are getting letters, and more concerningly, they're getting letters from the Interim Justa, which is the collection agency for the HSE. So they're being hounded by a collection debt agency. So that's true for everybody, but in particular, to be hounded for €800 bill for your involuntary incarceration in an approved centre is particularly galling.
Yeah. So I also wanted to ask you, you worked as a psychiatric nurse for many years, is that right?
Yeah.
So how do you think does it impact you on your viewpoint on the subject, or does it impact you on your viewpoint on the subject?
I think it must do. I mean, for over 30 years, listening to people crying, very disturbed, volatile, at times violent, but expressing their wish not to be incarcerated, not to be there. And moreover than not, a lot of people do need the care and protection of the health services when they're that vulnerable. But the absolute determination by some people who are incarcerated not to be there, and almost then the double whammy of a slap in the face to be produced with a bill and to be hounded by a debt agency for something that you never ever wanted, and moreover than not it was necessary, but the distress, added distress that would cause to individuals, it's just not doable.
So why do you think it's such an important issue, and why do you think it hasn't been tried to be changed before?
For me, it's an issue of justice, human rights, liberty. It touches on everything. When we take someone's liberty away from us, it is really serious, and we need to make sure that we take that it's not run of the mill, that these 2,000 people per year, we actually think about what we're doing to them, as opposed to it becoming automatic. It's been asked to pay for that from the patient, the person's perspective. I think ideologically, also, the government has signed up to Sláintecare. Sláintecare is the universal access to health that will allow everybody, regardless of their means to pay, access on a free basis, universally, on need. And they've signed up to that, but I don't believe ideologically they have any intention of implementing that. This was a cross-party document, a fantastic document that was signed off on last year by every party here for universal healthcare, which would mean the two tiers of the private and the public would cease to exist, and that everybody would have access at need. So it's, while I'm picking at the small bits, and this would be considered a fairly small bit within the whole remit of health, the ideal is the implementation of Sláintecare. In the meantime, though, God knows where it's going to go. So in the meantime, you really have to pick up on anomalies that are staring you in the face, that are absolutely disgraceful and unjust, and oversight, perhaps. I'm being very generous to the HSE. I think oversight, definitely, and not actually thinking that this is an important, or even registering on their radar that this is what goes on. So small amendments to bills while we await the implementation of a fair, just society where we have health for all based on need, not wealth.
So in a video posted on the Sinn Féin Twitter account, you explained that patients have been charged for 80 euros, yeah. And you also explained it to us now, but 80 euros a day for involuntary detention, and that it goes against equality and human rights.
Yeah.
So in which way do you think that this is a violation of your constitutional rights?
I think it's a violation of, if I was to say to you, you can't move, you're in this room and I don't want you to go out, you're not going to go, but I'm doing it because I believe that you need that. I mean, you're there for, your freedom is entirely restricted.
Yeah.
It is an infringement on your rights, but it's an infringement that is appropriate for you to keep you safe and other people safe, mm-hmm. and to make sure that you receive what treatment is necessary for you. But then on top of that, not only are you sitting there being told by me what to do, how to act, how to eat, when to eat, all the stuff that we're so used to doing ourselves and making choices of, and then I don't have a choice of being there. And on top of that, then someone's going to be knocking on my door and phoning me and harassing me for 800 euros, which is the maximum, on top of all that, for an experience that I didn't want in the first place. So it just goes against natural justice, health justice. It goes against anything that we might see as being fair, equitable, and sensible. Sensible, yeah. I think, as well.
So, say the legislation is successful and charging mental health patients who have been involuntarily detained is abolished. So what would this change for the patients, nurses, and people involved?
Well, I suppose it will take away, I mean, in the first instance, it takes away the idea that you are going to be of a monetary exchange. It's a monetary exchange that is unnecessary and unwanted from one party, right? So one party in this exchange are being pulled into this exchange they don't want it in the first place, but also then they you know, they're being paid for what they are being asked to pay for what they want. I think it just sends out a message. It is stepping stones towards Sláinte Care, towards equality for us all, and that if I am extremely unwell, I'm not going to be charged for being extremely unwell. We see certainly the part of privatisation of, especially say, like, you know, nursing homes. I've been quite aware of that in the past and still going on, where they cherry pick people to say, well, we'll admit your mammy or your granny because they don't have really complex needs, but we would not admit anybody with complex needs, so significant dementia needs, or if I'm already in a nursing home and then I become much more unwell via dementia when I was okay to begin with, well, we can't cater with that anymore. So there's cherry picking of in the private sector, whereas the public sector are left always with the weight of the what you would say is the really complex demanding needs. So it's trying to even all that up and just question, where is our health justice? So at every point of where you think there's an injustice going on, you need to shout about it. You need to stand up and say something about it, as opposed to go, which the minister did when I brought it to him in a topical question. Can't do it. That means we'd have to look into all the cases. It would take too much time, and we're not talking about massive numbers here, and we're not going to be able to do that. And, you know, I think you need to just say, wrong, yeah. Let's fix it, let's do something about it. So I hope that answers the question.
Yeah. So also, because you said on Twitter you would be lodging legislation and appeal of this violation in the Senate.
Yeah.
So have you received any response from the Senate yet?
Yeah, it's lodged. It's on the order paper, what it's called. It's on the order paper unanimously. So it has been supported, while the Minister, Jim Daly, has said he wouldn't be really bothered about it in the topical question on the floor of the Senate. It has been accepted, and accepted by the leader, who's Fine Gael. He's the leader of the House, so they have accepted it. Now, it has to go through separate stages. And often they'll accept it so they don't divide the House. But actually, I would love for somebody to stand up and say, we don't agree with this. Jim said it in a sense that it might be too onerous administratively wise. Mm-hmm. I don't think that's any excuse for something that's a complete obvious injustice, right?
Yeah.
So if someone stood up in the Senate and said, I don't believe in this, well, why don't you believe in it? Why won't you support it? How can you, in all conscience and fairness and in your duty as a public rep for everybody in your constituency, how can you stand up and say, I don't support this? You have to support it. It's a no-brainer. It's an absolute no-brainer.
My thanks to Pia and Joe for doing their first Mental Wealth interview with Senator Maura Devine. Thanks to Maura Devine as well for her time on that particular one. And we'll track the legislation, and if there's any updates, we'll check in with Senator Devine and see what the updates are as that one progresses through Shannadarran and Dáil-Éireann. You're with 103.2 Dublin City FM. This is Mental Wealth with Brian Green. And next to all things music, the Orty Choice Prize Conversations Fringe kind of conference was on last week, and they were talking all things music. And one of the particular panels they had was on music and mental health. And we have a couple of interviews from that that we'll play over the next few weeks. And to start, I had a chat with the chairperson of IMRO, Eleanor McAvoy, and Aoife Ruth from BIM, who is a psychotherapist and has a keen interest in all things mental health and music. And I began by asking them, what was the panel discussion all about? All very interesting. If we could review in a couple of minutes what we've just heard from the stage. Aoife, what you were talking about, mental health and music and musicians and your own entry into the space. You've got your own experiences which kind of sharpen your direction as you are a psychotherapist in the space now and working in BIM. So how has your early kind of formation and foundation with music influenced you?
Oh, I think hugely, because I mean, I would have got into music, you know, from 3 years of age. So if you think about it, even from a psychological point of view, as that my talent was developing at the same time as my ego. So it really takes over your identity. So my earliest years were really about being, I am the musician and that's what I am and that's what I know myself to be. So in a way, my journey has been around, I suppose, trying to kind of get that straight in my head and trying to maybe separate where I see myself worth just being around being a musician and seeing it more as kind of a rounded thing. I've always had an interest in psychology. I've always loved music. So, you know, I've kind of been going between the two for years and finally in the last couple of years have kind of drawn those strands together. So,
Eleanor, you're a late starter. You started at the age of 4.
That's right. Actually, I started at 3, actually. I did actually start. I started piano at 3, kind of first played on stage at the age of 4, so I suppose that's where it comes from. I find it very interesting what you're saying about that, because I had the same experience. I was the musician. Well, we were three musicians, you know, myself, my brother and my sister, but it's completely, we were the musical household on the street, etc. And it is kind of part of your identity. And to be honest, I can't separate it from my identity. Now, I don't really have any other strand to my bow. I'm shockingly ignorant about other subjects. Don't know anything about sport. I wish I did. I wish I had a kind of a sports side. But having said that, music's like breathing to me. So it works well for me, I guess.
Aoife, you said you were burnt out at 10. It's not mainly that I'm trying to find out about you and it personally, but how does that kind of make you think about the whole music industry as you look at it now?
Oh, I think it's a tricky one, because I think at that age, you know, in the classical world, you're probably making early career decisions at a time when psychologically you're probably not developed enough to be making them. But I think, you know, there's many ways of kind of thinking about the industry and thinking about it that way. In a way, I was kind of brought up within classical music and kind of, I suppose, came of age playing rock and indie. So I suppose in some ways, when I think about the industry, in my head, I just think about my relationships. I think about the bands I've been in. I think about the camaraderie. I think about, you know, really kind of the positive side. And I suppose also then the side where maybe some of those early experiences would have made me think, I'm not good enough. I'm not rock enough, or I'm not playing the right kind of music, or I'm not wearing the right kind of clothes, you know, and kind of having that self-doubt. So I think really where what has really shifted for me, I think the deeper I've gotten into maybe the psychotherapy side of things, is that I'm really sort of playing it on my own terms. I happen to exist within an industry, but I'm not playing my music for an industry. I'm playing it for me.
A question for both of you, less to the 10-year-old self, but to maybe the slightly older person who is working in the industry now. What are the working conditions like?
Oh, wow. They're shocking. I mean, you know, I get changed in kitchens all the time. I've seen the kitchen of every place where you play. I mean, people do think it's glamorous and, oh, my God, it's something but glamorous. But, you know, for me, that's not why I got into it. I got into it to do the music. That's what floats my boat still to this day. That's what puts the light in my eyes is, oh, my God, should I really be putting an F sharp minor underneath that lyric? You know, that's what'll get me out of bed. It'll get me out of bed. I mean, I don't get out of bed if the building's on fire, you know. So, you know, the power of melody, chord progression, that can get me out of bed. But yeah, the industry itself, I have to say, it was always hard. It was hard when I was starting out, but it is worse now. It is so hard for people starting out now. And I think the biggest thing is the lack of financial, you're just not well paid. You're not paid at all. And a lot of times you're losing money, you know, to do, and the pressure that brings with it. And, you know, having to do 4 times the amount of work for 1/6 of the money and working ridiculously long hours and the toll that it takes on you and your family and your household, etc. So that's the biggest thing.
Going back in time, about 20 years ago, Christa Berg got a bad review and he decided to take it to the letters to the editor about the bad review. And it became a bit of a thing, a meme, before memes existed in the internet space. You had a point about reviews and keeping the good ones. Tell us about that.
I think this in general, I think people in all walks of life, I don't think this is, you know, isolated to music, but I think we have a tendency to focus on all the things we did wrong or all the things we should have said instead of that or whatever it is. And we very quickly gloss over the positives or times when people say, hey, you're really good at that, or, you know, give us praise for things. And I think more attention has to be given to that. I think reviews are a funny thing, and I think every artist probably has their own, I suppose, level of how much they're going to read into that, or how much they're going to expose themselves to what's being said. I was listening to, I think it was Johnny Greenwood on Adam Buxton, and he was saying, no, the worst ones are when you get a very good review, because it almost gives you this false sense of security. So in some ways, it's maybe not just kind of a bad review, but I stress it, I suppose, even teaching in BIM, but working with clients as well, is that really focusing and keeping a record of all of the things that you're doing well. It's like you can have that in the bank. So when you do have the bad day, you can take it out and go, okay, let's look at the evidence. Actually, I'm okay. I'm pretty good. I'm doing this well. Everything isn't going to pot here. This is positive, and I can focus on this as well.
I'm pretty sure I know the answer to this question, but where is a musician's go-to happy place?
In the music. It is in the music. I mean, it really is. And it's funny, for me, live music does one thing to me, you know, and recorded music does another. You know, I love every strand of music. I love disposable pop for, you know, if I'm doing the hoovering, or I'm doing, you know, putting the bins out, you know, just singing along, real disposable pop. That fulfills a great function for me. You know, jazz will fulfill another function for me in the evening when I'm cooking and I have a glass of wine in my hand. You know, if I'm feeling down, the Brandenburg Concertos will lift me up when I'm, you know, on a Sunday morning, you know. So, music. It's music for me that lifts me up always.
Last question to both of you. Would you encourage your children to go into the music industry?
Oh, God. You know, I struggle with this one because I suppose myself and my husband are kind of at that stage where we're thinking about things like this. And he's also a musician. And what I love about music, and maybe it is the happy place for me as well, is that there's something almost childlike in playing. Like, there's a reason we call it playing music, is because you play. You experiment and you go, what happens when I do this? Oh, that's interesting. I'll do it again, you know. And I think that's a wonderful, wonderful experience. I think the issue is more where self-worth starts coming into the equation, and kind of you are good if you play well or if you play to this standard. And I think that is, I actually think it's quite toxic. So I would love to see my children go their own way, I suppose, and kind of, you know, they'll be in a house where they're going to be tripping over instruments. So if they trip and land, that will be good. And if they don't, then, you know, let's see what else they like.
Should they be thinking of BIM or similar?
Well, just might have to say from my own perspective, my daughter lives in a house where she trips over an instrument, you know, every time she puts her foot onto the floor. But I have to say, I would not want her to get into the music industry. I'd actually be a little sad and upset if she got into the music industry. If she wanted to, of course, I'd support her. Now, she's...
You'd be a support act.
Yeah. I would. Of course you would, for your kids. You'd do anything. But she says something interesting. She says, Mum, I really love music. And she's a beautiful jazz pianist, you know. But she goes, why do you do it on stage? Why do you want to do it on stage? Question. And I kind of think, oh my God, she's just so much smarter than I am.
Biennia.
Maybe, yeah.
Aoife and Eleanor, thank you very much for your time today.
Absolute pleasure.
Thank you very much. Great to talk.
My thanks to Aoife Ruth of BIM and Eleanor McAvoy of IMRO. Very interesting discussion on music and mental health. And music is something I have to agree that is very uplifting. And only yesterday I was driving in the car, and on the radio comes a song, and I'm going, what is that? I love that sound. Where can I find out more details about that? And of course, we've got the internet now, and you can find out all sorts of facts about songs at the touch of a button or the swipe of a finger across a piece of glass. The song I heard was from Sarah Buckley, and it was so wonderful. I decided I'd track down the single and play it for you today. This is Sarah Buckley, and You've Got Me.
You've got me, you've got me, down to my toes, and you don't understand it. You don't know that you've got me, down to my toes. You'll never know, I know. try to change a thing that you are, 'cause in another girl's world you'd make the star. But you've got me down to my toes, and you don't understand it. You don't know. Just me and you. The fun will only last as long as what we do, 'cause then we're up and on the phone, we're fighting by noon. You whip me in your hurricane, you spin me around, shouting at the ceiling, pummeling the ground, running in a hoop to get your story straight. Then we stop and have a pint. Of course I think you're great, 'cause you've got me to my toes, and you don't understand it. You don't know that you've got me. You've got me down to my toes. You'll never know, and I can't sign up to a life like this. But there's something in your eye that I'd always miss.
Sound of Sarah Buckley and You've Got Me. And you can find more about Sarah Buckley on YouTube and Spotify and all the usual places. Mental Wealth on 103.2 Dublin City FM. My thanks to our new recruits Joe and Pia for their time and energy and their attendance at a couple of events for me last week, and we'll be hearing more of them in the coming weeks. If you've got anything for the programme, email it in mentalwealth@dublincityfm.ie. I'm back next Tuesday, 12:30. Until then, have a great week. Stay safe, take care, and goodbye.